This is Conversations That Count. I'm Brent Cunningham. Today I'll be speaking with Wes Tucker. For the past 18 years, Wes has been working with Arab World Ministries, which is an evangelical and international mission dedicated to reaching the Arab-speaking Muslim world with the gospel. Today I'll be talking with Wes about how we can understand Islam better, as well as ways in which we can embrace our Muslim neighbors and share Christ with them. I hope you'll join us in this conversation and be as challenged as we are. Wes, tell me a little bit about why we're facing Islam like we are. Islam seems to be kind of on the front page of everything, our minds, our culture. You turn TV on, you know, we're coming up to, we were just talking about a little while ago, coming up to the fifth anniversary of 9/11, right? The destruction of two locations here in the United States that are kind of icons for the West. And so it seems like Islam has kind of hit us all of a sudden, and a lot of us just don't know what to make of it. Tell me a little bit about your interaction with Islam.
Well, my wife and I first became interested in Islam when I was studying at Denver Seminary back in the early 80s. And there we met some professors and some individuals that knew a lot more than we did, of course, about Islam, and I had known practically nothing. And Islam at that point, really in the early 80s, wasn't much of an issue. Nobody was talking about it much in the Muslim world, except for Israel. It was a pretty quiet scene. But the more I studied it, the more I realized that this was an area in the world that, or a population in the world that the church wasn't doing much about, wasn't reaching out to. And it's only been in maybe the last 100 years that the church has begun to mobilize itself and to begin to share the gospel with Muslims around the world. I think part of the reason that we've seen resistance to the gospel is just that the groundwork hasn't been laid in many Muslim countries, and their exposure to the gospel has been very, very limited. We've gone traditionally in mission work to the easier fields of, say, Africa or Latin America, and ignored the hard fields where we feel the resistance is higher, such as the Muslim world. So we, the more we found out about it, the more we saw the need. That's what touched our hearts, was that the need was so great and that the church was doing so little, and that's what called me to get involved in some form of outreach to sharing the gospel with Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Now, that need that you saw led you into some action, right? Tell me about where you and Geertie have been over the past few years.
We joined a mission organization called Arab World Ministries. It's probably one of the oldest mission organizations that reaches out to Muslims in the world today. It got started in the late 1800s as a British mission. And they work mainly in the Arabic-speaking world. We decided to work with the population of North Africans that lives in France because it's a place that you can share the gospel without fear of being booted from a country or any kind of more radical reprisal that you might see if you were ministering, say, in Saudi Arabia. You can share openly on the street, even with Muslims in France. And it's the largest Muslim population in Europe outside of Muslim countries.
That is
so
amazing.
The opportunities were great. Huh. So we were there from 88 until 2004, 16 years, and just came back here 2 years ago to Fort Collins to get one of our sons through high school. That's the reason we're here now. But we're still continuing the work up and down the Front Range because Colorado has its share of Muslims too. I think there's something like 50,000 Muslims that live on Colorado's Front Range. And now our goal is to try to share the gospel with each and every one of them.
50,000 Muslims up and down just the Front Range here.
That's right. That's what we've heard, statistics anywhere from 30 all the way up to 60. Nobody knows for sure. But at least there's plenty of them to try to be reached. And so for now, that's our goal, is to mobilize the church and try to get those folks reached with the gospel.
Yeah. So this is not something that is far off. I mean, we're not talking about this theoretically. We're talking about, well, you and I could walk outside the front door right now and connect with a Muslim neighbor, a Muslim store owner, coworker.
Most definitely, and probably the biggest opportunity right here in Fort Collins is with Muslim students. There's been a new agreement between the Saudi government and the United States to send over thousands of fully scholarship students every year. So we're seeing them show up on our campuses in Boulder and here in Fort Collins and in Greeley. And I think here in Fort Collins there's something like 200 Saudi students fresh off the plane.
Wow.
That are beginning to study English and will take up their studies next year.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to get into, this is kind of where we're going here as we have this conversation, Wes. How do we make inroads? How do we talk to the Muslim student or the Muslim coworker or the Muslim friend, whatever it might be, in a loving way? How do we do it? What do we say? And all that sort of thing. I want to get there. But I just want to say, you know, one thing I appreciate about you, Wes, is just the heart that you have. You don't have a us-them mentality, but it's really a heart to love, to reach out.
I look at Muslims as almost, and it might be wrong to say it this way, but it's probably easier to understand, as actually being victims of Islam. People that have not known anything else, no other information, usually in their countries, ever gets through. And so they think Islam is the be-all, end-all, and they need us to help them broaden their horizon and know that God has much more greater things out there for them. And so becoming their friends and loving them for Christ's sake is the first step in helping them to understand that.
Wes, a lot of us, when we think of Islam, there's a big question mark in our mind. What is it? We seem to almost maybe piece together what we know about their theology from little news clippings that we read or things we see from talking heads on TV or listen to on the radio. But, you know, if we actually think, okay, what is Islam? Maybe the best thing for us to do would be to spend 60 seconds on just going over how did it start. You know, I know Muhammad, you know, he comes to us, what, about 500 years after the life of Jesus.
That's correct. Yeah, born in 570 A.D.
Born in Mecca.
Right.
Right, into a fairly prominent family. He's raised by his uncle. He marries a woman who's a little bit older than him. And then when he's, what, is it 40 years old, he receives his first vision.
That's right. Starts getting revelations. And he was somebody who really wanted to find the truth. And he'd had a bit of contact with Jews and Christians that were living in the area. Muhammad was a caravan driver for his first wife. And so he had the chance to go up into Israel and even to Syria, I believe, and interact with Jews and Christians and learned a lot from them about monotheism. And that's the thing that he loved the most in their thinking, was that they were monotheistic. And that drew him to them. But he had his own ideas about what that should look like.
And then Muhammad began to preach in 612. And for about the next 20 years, he dies in 632.
That's right.
And so for about the next 20 years, basically, he's preaching his understanding of what God is saying, how God is communicating to the people, and continues to receive revelations. During that time, he's reciting it to his disciples, writing it down.
Mm-hmm.
And that is what we have as the Quran.
Quran today, which was collated after his death, several years after his death. People decided that, hey, we better gather this into one book so that we don't lose it and we can decide what is definitively from Muhammad and what isn't. Everyone says that Muhammad didn't know how to read or write, and I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind, because had Muhammad known how to read or write, he could have read the Bible, and he could have maybe studied more for himself and understood what God's plan was, because things like God sending his son to die for our sins made no sense to Muhammad. In his mind, a prophet of God was victorious and could not be defeated. Hmm. And so to hear that Christ was killed just didn't enter into his thinking. So he came up with his own form of what it would mean to follow the one true God. And it turns out that Islam becomes a very works-oriented system from that point on. The idea of grace and God intervening in our existence is foreign to him. God is too other and too distant, too transcendental to interact directly with human beings as he does in the Bible.
Hmm.
So the Quran is basically just a system of what you must do as a believer, how you must serve God and follow his rules in order to hopefully attain paradise one day. There's no assurance of salvation. There's no assurance of forgiveness of sins in Islam. So you've got to work as best you can and try to get the best score you can on the test in hopes that God will be merciful on the Day of Judgment. But still, a Muslim has no assurance of that.
Hmm.
And I just wanted to say that that's probably one of the biggest things that we have to offer Muslims today, is that through the message of Jesus, we can know assurance, and we can know that we're saved. We can know God's love for us personally, which is totally foreign to their experience.
We've been talking about how one guy, Muhammad, He forms an army. He starts actually fighting with this small army with the Meccans, right, in Mecca, mm-hmm. of this day, and basically destroys them with a band of his warriors. I think it's around 630. And he kind of destroys their idols, their temples, attempts to restore worship of the one true God, right, builds the first mosque. And then, of course, there's the sacred black stone where all Muslims pray toward today, where they believe that Abraham was tempted to sacrifice his son, not Isaac, but Ishmael, on that stone. And so they pray toward that today. It's the most holy shrine in Islam, right?
That's right.
And so how did it get his influence and his power as almost a military leader grows over the years?
Mm-hmm. When Muhammad started out, he was very peaceful. He lived in Mecca and tried to influence the tribes that lived there, principally the Quraysh tribe, which was the principal tribe in Mecca. As he met rejection there, he realized that he would have to come up with a different tactic, and he received an invitation from the people in Medina, which was a city about, I think, 200 miles north of Mecca. And they received him because they wanted somebody that was a leader who could organize them and protect them. So Muhammad moved up there, and that's when the tone changes in the Quran. Yeah. The revelations change from peaceful, conciliatory verses to ones that are more radical, more attacking, more aggressive. And so you can practically divide the Quran into those two halves, the Medinan period, the Meccan period, and the Medinan period. One is pacifistic, and the other is warlike.
So now, is that why, Wes, you can find some verses that will talk about Islam being peaceful, reaching out in a sense, almost an evangelistic type tone, and then you can find other verses later on, which talk more about, you know, subdue, submit, kill the infidel if they do not.
Mm-hmm. That's basically right, except that the Quran isn't divided into, it's not chronologically ordered, it's a jumble. So you'll find Medinan verses mixed in with Meccan verses and chapters, and so you never know really where you're at unless you have time to study the history of each chapter. But people have done that and divided it out that way, but you very clearly see the peaceful pronouncements early on and the more aggressive ones later on.
Mm-hmm. And so real quickly, run through, if you would, talk about the five doctrines of Islam, right? The five pillars mm-hmm. of Islam.
Yeah. People talk about the five pillars of faith, and these are the things that a Muslim must believe and do in order to be a good Muslim. The first one is the shahada, or the confession of faith, which is there is no God but Allah, and Muhammad is his messenger. If you say that with sincerity, you're a Muslim. That's all it takes to become a Muslim. One of the second obligations is prayer, which they do perform five times a day, linked in with ceremonial washings. Each time they must be cleaned ceremonially, and they'll perform their five prayers throughout the day. There's also the month of Ramadan, which is the month of fasting, which from sunup to sundown, they don't eat, smoke, drink, or have sexual relations. After the sun goes down, they're allowed to do all of the above. This is supposed to help them have more compassion for people less fortunate than themselves, and also leads them into a bit of more spiritual purity and devotion. The fourth pillar would be giving alms, or zakat, as they say, and that amounts to about 1.5% of their income, which they're supposed to give every year. And then the last one is the pilgrimage to Mecca, the Hajj, which a good Muslim is supposed to perform at least once in his lifetime, to perform the ritual pilgrimage. And it costs usually quite a bit of money for anybody coming from outside of Saudi Arabia, but now there are millions of people that come every year to perform the Hajj. So if a Muslim performs these five duties more or less regularly, then his chance of being accepted by God and going to paradise increase on the Day of Judgment. But once again, he can do all that perfectly and still have no assurance that God will accept it.
For more information on this audio recording or others like it, go to www.brentcunningham.org. All Bible passages read on this recording were from the New International Version, unless otherwise noted.